Hello and welcome back to Manga Kaiwa. After another 1 week hiatus, but nonetheless, we are back and ready for action.
Yes, indeed. I am pretty excited because this is another one of those episodes that I think covers a pretty broad topic, but you know, it's one that I really like talking about. Actually, it probably might be like one of the topics that I'm most excited to talk about, like before an episode at least, like comparing to our last few top 10s, which were also great. Like, I just love this topic. But yes, Ben, would you like to introduce it for us?
All right. So we will be doing top 10 story arcs in manga. So yeah, so these are, basically arcs, sagas, specific segments of the story that have like a central core or central focus, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so basically, you know, obviously it is subjective as to how different segments of the story do mesh with each other. But, you know, there is a generally, for most series at least, there are generally agreed upon kind of like borders, like where one segment of a story ends and the other one starts, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess for me, at least, I don't know if I can speak about this for on your part as well, but I've mostly chosen titles of arcs corresponding to how the fan base typically refers to them. And I'm considering the kind of span from one to the next. So when it starts and it ends. Because again, like, yeah, you could probably argue, you know, over where it ends and starts, but generally it's the same thing for everyone. Yeah. Alrighty. So Ben, if you wouldn't mind, I could maybe go ahead today. Do the first one on the list. Alrighty. Yeah. So the first one on my list, my number 10 for any manga arcs is the Winter War from Blade of the Immortal. I mean, I feel like I've actually been talking about the series a lot more in the last few episodes. I mean, I haven't been mentioning it since we've started recording and putting up episodes and stuff. But I mean, I've got to say, like, you know, Blade of the Immortal, when I think of it these days, like, I don't know why, but I'm making more comparisons to it than I used to with like series that I'm currently like keeping up with or reading. Like, for some reason, I'm realizing just how good it is, because when I see something good in a series that I'm reading right now, I very often find myself saying, oh, wait, that's what Blade of the Immortal sort of did. And I think like one of the really great things about Blade of the Immortal is its final arc, which is the Winter War. And I think what it does is really like a model kind of execution, in my opinion, of what final arc should be for a lot of other series. I'm not saying, you know, absolute final, like what it should be. I'm saying it's definitely commendable. I think it definitely deserves its place in the top 10. I'm not putting it higher because I think there are other arcs that are just much more, I don't know, unique and like really imprinted on me. But when I think of Blade of the Immortal, I think of this arc, which is saying something. I guess, you know, without trying to get into any kind of spoilers, and of course there will be minor spoilers and perhaps a few major ones throughout this recording, because we're talking about story arcs that aren't always going to, you know, come from the beginning of a story. But Winter War is the climax, basically, where all of these factions we've been following throughout the series really converge. And because Blade of the Immortal is a series that focuses so much on this lack of absoluteness, this gray area of morality, and like just, you know, how really, you know, and again, it's not the only series that tackles this, but how, you know, really at the end of the day, morality is for many people, not everyone, but for many people, just an excuse that they give themselves to achieve a certain goal. And how, you know, realizing that is a journey in and of itself. And really, what I really like about this is that it ties up all the ends really well. The final battle between this obsessive kind of like, I guess, a shogunate officer who's been hunting down one of the main kind of players in the story for who knows how long and is ready to commit seppuku if he fails. And like, it's all of these really, I mean, I guess I could say that Blade of the Immortal's story leading up to this point has been like every faction, every plot thread gaining momentum. And then the Winter War is where they all just slam against each other. And I think, you know, that's one of the things that makes this arc amazing, is that we get so many like satisfying moments where we finally get closure on a lot of the tensions that have going on that have been going on between characters. It's not so much like, you know, I guess world ending events or I don't know, just plot threads that have gone really complicated and are going to get tied together now. It's just these characters' motivations that are clashing. And it's kind of that rawness that I really liked about this arc. I mean, yeah, it is amazing. And it is one of the best aspects of Blade of Immortal for sure. Yeah, that's my number 10.
Yeah. All right. So my number 10 is R1 from Code Geass. So basically the first season, or I guess the first half of the series before R2, obviously. So I feel like R1 is fun to watch. I feel like I prefer R1, like first season, because I feel like watching like Lelouch, the protagonist, rise to power is very it's very entertaining to see. I feel like not entertaining but captivating, I guess. You get to see how like you're sort of introduced to Lelouch and his motivations and sort of his rivalry with Suzaku, and how he's able to sort of assemble the Black Knights and lead them. It's definitely I feel like where the series I think hits its highs, I guess. It ends on like this very very big cliffhanger.
My God,
you're not sure. Yeah. But you really see like, you know, I will point to this one moment that just like really, you know, sticks with me even now. It's where Lelouch, you know, indirectly causes, you know, basically masses of people to get killed. And,
exactly. I was about to bring up that point after you were done with your kind of commentary, because that is like the moment in Code Geass that I think is probably one of the most brilliant moments in like everything.
It is. It's so frustrating and so hard to watch, but honestly, it's so brilliant, because you know how like Lelouch, you know, through his power of like, you know, his Geass, which essentially makes people do whatever he wants, he, you know, he accidentally orders
Euphemia
to murder the Japanese people. And it's like, you know, it's so frustrating to watch, because you know Lelouch never wanted any of this, but you see how even so he has to take advantage of the situation in order to, you know, rally the people against the empire, the Britannian Empire.
I get what you're saying. It's like, it just, you're clenching your teeth after the scene, because
exactly,
you know, that, you know, going through what Lelouch is going through in order to achieve his goals must be pressuring enough, especially considering that he does have to do quote-unquote necessary evils already. He's already aware of that, but now that he piles on a mistake, an avoidable mistake that is not just a mistake but a massive mistake onto that whole burden, like, you can feel like, oh damn, like Lelouch is under some massive pressure right now. Oh my God. Yeah. And I mean, obviously it rockets up the tensions because of Suzaku's connection to Euphemia, and makes that cliffhanger at the end all the more like, just, oh my God. I just, oh my God. Yeah. I mean, R1 is definitely great. I think that R2 is the one that's talked about most often, obviously because of, you know, the Zero Requiem and how just like bombastic that was when it came out. How like it just blew everybody's minds. But I mean, R1 definitely deserves its praise, that's for sure. Nice. All right. So I'm going to move on to my number 9, which is Searching for Alan Walker from the Gray Man series. So this arc is, I think, you know, a weird kind of, it has a weird place in, I think, the hearts of not only me, but many, many fans, because it is sort of torturous and wonderful at the same time. Obviously, The Gray Man is a series that is notorious for its hiatuses, you know, unfortunately, not unlike a lot of other very good series these days. And this arc is happening right before this massive hiatus, or let's just say the very dramatic slowing of the release schedule that we're currently kind of affected by as fans now. I don't think there's been a single D. Gray Man chapter released since I finished the series, even though there's an unofficial official schedule. But like this arc came in that slow period, or at least right before. And now we're sort of left with the succeeding arc. So the arc after the arc that I'm referring to right now, Searching for AW. And it's just like, no, I want to continue this. And it's just like, but at the same time, it allows you to kind of slow down and appreciate just how groundbreaking what happened just was. I think what really is great about this is that throughout the whole series, the identity of the protagonist has been sort of like really layered up, like in a way where we essentially know that he's very, very enigmatic in his identity, even though he's lost his memory, blah, 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 and that he is definitely not exactly who we think he is. And that we should just give up on trying to know who he is. Basically, that's sort of what a lot of the story does in relation to the protagonist. It makes you just not want to assume anything. And then when it builds on that, and when it gives you actual answers in this arc, it's just like, oof, my God, because it's like a sentimental bomb that the author Hoshino throws on you, right? Because you're like, you realize that this protagonist that you've been following is the way that he is because of this. And also the changes that he's undergoing now are a consequence of his past, and that he's really just been toyed with by fate. And it's just so tragic and infuriating because you feel like there are these massive powers, these forces clashing throughout history, right? And he's just kind of like been pushed around by it all, even though he really doesn't want to. He just loves the people that he loves and wants to be with them. And then the antagonist, the way that the Millennium Earl, the main antagonist of the story, plays into this is just crazy. His breakdown in this arc, because I don't want to get into too many spoilers, but it's really complicated, actually. There's a lot of kind of weird networking of who reincarnated and who, and why this person possesses this person's spirit, and who the husk that the person was implanted in was. Oh my God, it gets really complicated because there's a lot of stuff with memories and memories being erased. And it just clears up so many kind of weird inconsistencies, or at least what we thought were inconsistencies before, and just like revolutionizes the protagonist-antagonist dynamic that was actually pretty simplistic until now. I mean, I could not have asked for more from this arc. It was just, and I love how it all takes place in this one very small setting, this small village where, you know, people have kind of taken asylum for a very short period of time, but then everything just goes down. I mean, it is amazing. And it also rides off of the end of a very other highly acclaimed arc that I think some people might've even like preferred over Searching for Alan Walker. It was, I think, the Seeds of Destruction arc. But I choose this purely because the Seeds of Destruction focused on a side character more than Alan Walker. And I mean, that sounds stupid, but that's not what I mean. I'm saying, because Alan is the protagonist, we've been able to be with him a lot more. And this climactic moment hits a bit harder because we know more. And we feel more connected to him purely because he's a protagonist. Seeds of Destruction was great, but Kanda, the kind of main character of that arc, if you will, I mean, it was sort of a bit sudden, I felt, because before that he was, you know, not very developed, I will say. In my opinion, he wasn't as developed as, it was a sudden acceleration in the Seeds of Destruction. Just wanted to add that in because I know that maybe some people might have preferred to see Seeds of Destruction in place of Searching for AW. Yeah.
All right. So my number eight is, is Chapter Black from Yu Yu Hakusho. So I look, I noticed that I have multiple of these on the list where, like, I have arcs that are, you know, I guess, you know, revered, they're liked, but they're not thought of to be the necessarily the best arc by a lot of the fan base. But yeah, I mean, I feel like here, like with the case of Yu Yu Hakusho, I feel like, you know, a lot of people would like immediately point to the, the Dark Tournament arc as being the best arc in Yu Yu. And I feel like, I mean, yeah, it is, the Dark Tournament is undoubtedly one of the best tournament arcs in anime, but I feel like there's just something about Chapter Black that just like pushes it like even further for me, honestly. So essentially, like, the whole premise of this arc is like well, I should say, you know, the villain Sensui is very interesting. Like, he's like this, you know, he's this huge contrast to Toguro. He's like this, you know, hulking, like, huge guy. Whereas Sensui is, you know, at first glance, just like kind of, you know, simply put, a more normal looking guy. I feel like Sensui is almost like a predecessor to Aizen from Bleach. He just has this very, like, methodical way of, like, going about things that is similar, and he's just, like, kind of, like, you know, oh, yes, everything is going
according. And he doesn't look harmful, necessarily, right? Like, I guess what you're saying.
Yeah.
He takes off the glasses.
Yeah.
No, I don't mean to interrupt, but I just remember when you were watching Yu, like, you would talk about that arc, and it was clear, like, that was the peak for you, which is just, I remember that. I remember you saying, like, you know, how Sensui and, like, the appearance of Ryzen and all that kind of stuff. I just need to get into Yu. I mean, but I remember specifically you talking about that arc. And, I mean, gosh, you were pretty amazed by it. So I can see why it's in your top 10, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I like how, like, Sensui and the other, like, antagonists in this arc sort of, like, play mind games with, like, the, you know, the protagonists. Like, it's not purely physical, but the fights in this arc are very well done. And it's specifically, I think the final fight with, Yusuke and Sensui, and, like, where, like, Yusuke, you know, it transforms into his demon form for the first time. That's just, like, honestly, peak UU for me, I will say.
Yeah. And I mean, that transformation is one of the best aesthetically, I think. I mean, it is very 90s, I will say, but it still looks
amazing. It is.
I mean, I don't know why I'm saying that, like, a criticism. I mean, it's a very, I guess it's more of an acquired taste kind of thing. You know, like, not in the pretentious sense, but, like, it is a bit unique. The 90s style, I'm referring to that. And I think UU completely embraces that. But I personally am a sucker for that, and it looks great. So I will say I need to get into UU, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
All right. So my number 8 is the Control Devil arc from Chainsaw Man. Okay, so this is actually the shortest arc, if I'm not mistaken, on this entire list. I mean, but what can I say? It's literally the final arc of Chainsaw Man. And one of the reasons why it is blowing up right now. I mean, obviously Chainsaw Man, you know, as a whole is a crazy series with, you know, a very kind of in your face aesthetic and style that is very fast paced and kind of just, I guess, off-putting. And it really does carve its place out, you know, through those elements that, I mean, I guess my point being, basically are ever present throughout the entire series. But, you know, this final section of part one, so the Control Devil arc, is really where you cannot, you are just like, you are in a trance when this arc happens. You are in a freaking trance because it opens up with a bang. You just come off the tails of what you thought was the craziest arc you had ever read. But then you get this, and it's even crazier somehow. And it's just like, I mean, again, it's very short. I think it's like not even more than, I think it's like 20 chapters or something like that. It's at the end of the series, or a little over that. And I think it's actually one of the longer arcs in Chainsaw Man, if I'm not mistaken, because Chainsaw Man is less than 100 chapters as of now, at least part one will always be. And just like, you know, okay, so I guess I can't beat around the bush. There has to be spoilers here. But Makima in this arc, it's just like, terrifying. It is terrifying. And the reveal of Chainsaw Man and like what he is and how just ridiculous his ability is and how just how that makes him overpowered and how if you were to write that down on a piece of paper, it would sound ridiculous. But if you see it as it is in the manga, it's just badass. It's just like, I don't know. This is why Chainsaw Man is Chainsaw Man for me. Like, this is like the purest form of its wacky, like, uniqueness that makes me love it. And I mean, it also adds a lot of sentiment that I have to say, like, you know, Chainsaw Man has always been good at it. In fact, Fujimoto, I've heard, is good at it. Although Chainsaw Man is the only series by him I'm reading, I'm planning on reading Fire Punch, which is supposed to also go into this kind of territory where it's just this weird, banal, like just weirdness. Like, imagine JoJo's, but with gore, and the gore is also part of the humor, and like the vulgarity is also part of the humor, and like somehow there's still sentiments tinged in these like really weird moments, like this kind of melancholy like sadness or happiness, like, and this is what that arc does, especially with its ending. And obviously you go through a whole roller coaster. Like, again, I have to emphasize, like, you just like got turned upside down 15 times in 1 second. And now you're going to go through it again after you thought that you wouldn't have to go through that your whole entire life again. I don't know if that's a good analogy, but that's literally what this is. It's like a roller coaster after a roller coaster that you didn't expect. Yeah.
Yeah, now I see. Yeah. So so you said, so this is the final arc of Chainsaw Man?
Yeah, well, so Chainsaw Man is coming back in the summer. So this is part one. So I think Fujimoto is trying to segment it a bit. Part one is what we have as of now. And this is like the most recent arc of that. So it's basically where Chainsaw Man left off. And it has been concluded. I mean, this arc has been concluded. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
It wraps up everything that we've kind of been going through with the antagonist of this arc. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, I definitely have to get into Chainsaw Man eventually. I have a few things on my list.
Yeah.
And I'm just, for some reason, I'm just like not getting to them because I'm just like so preoccupied with other stuff. But
Chainsaw Man might be one of the first things you want to go for, just in my personal opinion, because it's short and it's also very fast to read. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. All right. So, all right. So for my number eight is the Sasuke rescue arc from Naruto. So yeah. So this is the final arc of part one of Naruto. I feel like when I think about Naruto, this is honestly speaking, the peak of the series for me. I feel like. I mean, there are definitely, very good moments sprinkled throughout Shippuden, but this is really the high of the series for me. I feel like Naruto's resolve to get Sasuke, back to like not let Sasuke go down this dark path. I kind of like talked about this a lot, back when we did our top 10 fights, because I talked about Naruto versus Sasuke.
That fight is just crazy.
Yeah, it is. But, yeah, but I feel like, it's just so done. Like, Naruto's, conviction and, resolve is just so well done here. Whereas, later in Shippuden, I feel like, honestly, it gets, like, it just gets tiring. It's like,
yeah,
okay, I need to get Sasuke back, no matter what. I can't let him, do his own thing. I just have to get him back. It's just, it gets a little tiring after some point. But I feel like here, it's so well done, a lot of it, partly because it's, how fresh it is at this point, obviously, but
yeah.
I just, it's done well here, and I feel like, I'll also say that, this is really, an arc in Naruto where, the side characters, are yes. really able to shine,
Yes.
They're, yeah.
Yeah.
The team that, goes out, that Naruto goes with to get Sasuke back.
Mm-hmm.
Of course they each have their own fight with the Sound Four, and it's so fun to watch because they're each given their chance to shine and do cool stuff, and it's like it just feels pretty rewarding, honestly.
I think it's sort of like a weird relationship I have with this arc because it marks for me the definitive change in Naruto. We've been building up to this, and a lot of people have like this nostalgia sort of like connection, this nostalgic connection to part one, because Shippuden did represent quite a turning point in like the tone and just the way that the series behaves itself, like handles itself, right? But I think here what really I like about this is obviously Naruto is a battle shonen. It is a battle series with a power system that basically is an extension of what we've seen in a lot of other series prior to Naruto, like Dragon Ball, for example, and even like Bleach, which was running simultaneously. This is the internet energy system. And I think right here, if you're talking about escalation of powers, I think obviously Naruto is a prime example that people bring up when they're referring to it. And yeah, I do agree in certain senses that Shippuden does sort of suffer from that escalation of powers, like in an excessive way. I feel like this arc is where it's at the perfect sweet spot, actually. I think it is like the tipping point, but because you're at that tipping point, you're suspended there during this arc. I think it's amazing. Like, if I think of it, like, these characters have never ever been as skilled or powerful before this, but it feels still feels like the stakes are high and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think it's pretty cool. I have to say, that is probably the best arc narratively in Naruto. I mean, obviously pain is a huge factor, you know, in making a lot of Naruto fans decide on that arc, the pain arc, as the best arc in Naruto. I do appreciate Pain's narrative, but to me personally, I don't know about you, Ben, but my personal kind of like connection to Pain wasn't as strong as the one for Sasuke Retrieval. And it's just my opinion. Yeah. I mean, I'm not denying that Pain was well written. Like, if anything, he's probably the most kind of like just, I guess like solid, just like solid, not in like the average meh sense, but like just, like, there's not really anything you can directly criticize about Pain.
Yeah, for sure, yeah. But yeah, that's my number 8, the Sasuke rescue arc.
Yeah, it's a very good arc. Yeah. Yeah. So my number 7 is the Kamara Ant arc. The only arc on this list that I, Ben, I'm probably not going to talk about this too much because I'm assuming you're also going to have it in a later part of the list. But so the Kamara Ant arc, this is the only arc on this list that I've experienced solely through the anime. And I mean, this is really where the 2011 anime is just, oh my God. I mean, the soundtrack, the animation, just the way that they adapt the manga and what made that arc so special in the manga, and they just augment it. And here again, I guess that was a weird comparison since I haven't read the manga, but I guess, you know, I've seen some paneling, I've seen some analyses and stuff like that. So based off of that, I mean, it's an incomplete understanding of the manga experience, but I guess I'll just use that for now. I'm just wanting to acknowledge that. But I mean, the Kamara Ant arc is just something else. It's just, I just, whenever I think of this, I just think of that moment. Talking about soundtracks, Kage, you know, which is sort of like the nickname that a lot of people have given Gon's adult form, when he's transforming, the kind of ritualistic, like horror, almost like, you know, I guess like the hell-raising ritual sounding, I don't even know how to describe it, just track that's playing, and it's like basically Gon is just broken. It's just, oh my God, it's just so it's so sad almost, because I think of that part whenever I hear the words Chimera Ant, like, you know. But there are so many other things in this arc that are amazing. I mean, just
agree with personally, but I feel like here, like I feel like with the soundtrack in DBZ, I don't know, I feel like the American soundtrack done by Bruce Falconer, I think is his name, is I feel like it just brings out the highs in this series much better than I will say than the original soundtrack, in my honest opinion. But but hopefully you'll sort of get a sense of that. It's a very techno based soundtrack, which you wouldn't really associate with Dragon Ball, but I feel like it actually works pretty well. And so the soundtrack I'm about to play is the Dragon theme, which of course plays when the dragon Shenron is summoned, but also it actually plays during this very epic moment when Vegeta uses his final flash attack against Cell, and it's awesome. All right, so
I wonder what the connection between these two moments is. But anyway,
there's not much of a connection. It's just like they'll reuse the soundtrack. Yeah. So again, starts off very slow, sort of like building up. And I don't know if you skip ahead a bit.
Thank you. All right.
And yeah, so with that soundtrack, I feel like you get like a very good sense of like the character sort of like charging their attack in the typical DBZ fashion, as Vegeta does in the scene I mentioned with his final flash. And it's just like this sort of like very slow, like, but like epic buildup, which makes sense because like it takes a very long time for him to charge this attack in particular. But like when it finally hits, like it's just like it goes all out. It's like like when Vegeta actually fires his attack, it's a different soundtrack gets used, but it actually it very much blends in with the dragon theme very well. And so yeah, and then you get a sort of yeah. So and you get to see how the techno just very meshes very well with Dragon Ball Z, surprisingly. But yeah.
Well, then also like that sort of like the continuous sort of like eerie noise in the background, like it makes you know something is coming. Something is coming.
Something is coming. Yes.
Something is coming. It is a giant beam that will pierce the clouds. Yeah, but I've seen a lot of good things. I didn't know there were two different soundtracks, so that's interesting. But I will definitely keep that in mind and try to listen to it on my own. And then maybe actually listen to it when I finally get around to watching DBC. All right. I enough shaming of myself. All right. So I am going to get on to my number 6, which I'm not going to take too much time on because we actually did go over it in Ben's number 8. It was, or I think it was your number 7, wasn't it? If I'm not mistaken.
I think it was my number 8.
Cowboy Bebop. So Cowboy Bebop, I have kind of given a lot of my commentary when Ben uses entry, but it is this high on my list because I think what make Watanabe's animes so special, and I guess I kind of feel a bit a bit jaded in an unjustified way when saying this, because I haven't watched any other Watanabe production besides Bebop, but from what I know contextually, Watanabe does focus a lot on the kind of feeling that his anime gives, as opposed to the plot and the progression and the appeal of the actual like narrative elements of it, which again are important, but I think it's much more what you feel and what you assume according to the way scenes are made, the way scenes are paced, the way scenes are kind of meshed with soundtracks. And I think Bebop does that so well, especially, you know, because these are a band of rogues that we're following in the story, and you know they're scampering around, and like just as I said, you know, jazz is so versatile in terms of its pace, and that's really what happens. Like these guys are just chilling in space, and suddenly they're in some kind of crazy chase scene. You know what I'm saying? And it lends itself very, very well to the jazziness of it, and it's just so stylish as well, which really reflects a lot of, you know, the kind of badass character that is Spike, and just how he like, you know, he's just vibing to this jazz music, and he seems like he's dancing to it at the same time as he's like kicking someone's face or something like that, you know? Bebop is a great soundtrack, that's for sure. All right.
I mean, when Spike fights, it is almost kind of like a dance, you know? It's like he's dancing to the jazz in it. It's like flowing to it in a sense.
Yeah, because his feet move so fast when you watch the animation.
Yeah.
Carefully, like, he looks like he's like tap dancing or something.
Yeah.
All right, Ben, no, number 5.
All right. So number 5 is the Death Note soundtrack. So this is, very similar to the Code Geass soundtrack in the sense that it's a very dramatic soundtrack, very, which just goes to show, like, you know, the badassery of, like, Light and the other characters. And it's this very just dramatic soundtrack that goes very well with, like, you know, the sort of tone of the series of being this like sort of like non-battle anime in a sense, where like it's like the characters are engaged in like these battles but not, you know, actually physical ones, obviously. But
one of the greatest eye patch wolf videos in ever, by the way.
Yeah. All right. But yeah, so my sample track is Low of Solipsism, which sort of plays when Light, the protagonist, is just going all out with like writing people's names into Death Note, which, you know, causes people to die, hence the name. But yeah.
All and right. Eating potato chips.
And eating potato chips.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's one of the, that's, this is a very crazy album in terms of how it's like God descending on you down.
Yeah, dear Reese's, I hope this letter finds you in my
double
stomach.
Ad. Love. Double ad. No.
Why be happy so when grim. You can be sad? All right. Depression Stick. Learn more at depressionstick.com.
Yeah, building up.
In that moment, people are like flying.
So yeah, very dramatic indeed, but it does very much like match for sure of what White is doing. He's just, you know, he's just killing all these people and, you know, by extension, like remaking the world in his image, you know, as he eats his potato chips.
but did you see the comment of that guy? Like, this guy literally has gospel music playing in the background while he eats his snacks.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's all right. That should give a sense of like the very heavy dramatism of the Death Note soundtrack and you know, of Death Note in general as a series. But yeah.
Yeah. And so I mean, this series does appear higher on my list, I will say. The thing is that I think Death Note soundtrack is so interesting in the sense that it's very two-faced. Like, there are these really operatic, like almost like gospel or choir or like, you know, just doom style orchestral tracks that like really convey like this God complex that our main character is experiencing. But then there are almost like the down-to-earth, more like almost rocky, vibey tracks that play as ambient music that really encapsulate a lot of the normalcy that is actually happening in between these absolutely absurd events that basically are instigated by Light and whoever is trying to track him down and kill him or incarcerate him, whatever you'd like. Yeah, it's a very, very good soundtrack. And I will probably be emphasizing more that other side of the soundtrack. Although I appreciate low solipsism and like, you know, Kyrie and all those that are like really, really operatic and epic. I will probably be looking at the other things of the Death Note soundtrack when I list it. Exactly. All right, Ben, I feel like we're going to have a lot of repeats here because I'm sure you probably have this one somewhere. But my number five spot, you know, who knows, maybe. My number five spot is the Berserk OST from 1997. My God, there are, I think, 10 tracks that you can find in like the album coordination, but they're all so magical. And track number one immediately hits you with this very, very specific feeling. You probably all heard it, Baylet. Baylet is a very repetitive track, but my God, it's both wondrous. It makes you feel like you're staring into this vast abyss that is the world of Berserk at the same time. As it makes you aware that something is afoot, something sad and tragic and horrifying is like somewhere in this world, or at least completely throughout it. Let me just play it quickly. I think it is probably one of the most loopable tracks ever, and especially when you're reading Berserk, I will emphasize that. Gotta wait for the flute. Yeah, there it is. Yeah, so obviously that flute is very mysterious, but it is over anything else foreboding. And while you have like this almost like harp or like lute style instrument that is going on in the background, like it's just the perfect mix that encapsulates a lot of those like almost like dark but not completely terrifying moments in Berserk where things are not great, but they're not good either. In fact, they're more bad than good, but for Berserk standards, they're okay. I don't know. Like, I don't know, when like Guts is traveling, or like when he has like five arrows in his body, like, and he's chilling by a tree or something like that. Like, you know, it's just like, it shows you that Berserk really is never completely happy. It is just, this is, when I think of this song, and I know I've mentioned this before, but it's really hard to put into words. I'm going to try one more time. It gives you an image of the landscape that is a setting of Berserk in kind of a tone style. This kind of like, you know, it's mysterious, it's medieval, it's elegant, but it's also terrifying and brutal and unforgiving, which I think is really great that that track is able to convey that. And a lot of the other tracks have all, you know, this is a very light track, but it still has some heavy elements, like the lute or the harp in the background. And a lot of the other tracks from this soundtrack have very heavy elements as well that convey the tension of that moment. And again, like the Yu Yu Hakusho soundtrack, actually really own their time, in my opinion. Like Forces and Ghosts, amazing. And not to mention, obviously, the one that everybody knows, Guts theme.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so Berserk does show up on my list as well. But I will say, like, speaking to Bayouet specifically, I find that, I mean, it does play, you know, a good amount of times, like, throughout the series. But I actually associate it the most personally with the Eclipse. So, like, basically, you know, the absolute worst of Berserk. And well,
okay, so I will tell you the exact image that I see when I see this image, when I hear this. And I actually haven't watched the 1997 anime. I just included this because I feel like I have the right to, as someone who has thought about Berserk as much as possible. The general rule for me on this was that even if I had read the manga and I hadn't watched the anime, I wouldn't include the soundtrack. But for Berserk, it's not a complete adaptation. I still feel like, you know, it is perfect for the manga as well, actually, which is uncommon among anime soundtracks. But the image I get when I see this is 1997 Griffith, after, you know, post-torture Griffith, sitting in that kind of puddle, holding the Baylet in front of the setting sun. Like, you know that panel, right? The legendary panel.
Yeah.
Basically decides to use the Baylet. That's the image I get when I hear the Baylet. Yeah, which just makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and I definitely, yeah, and because of that, like, because of, like, how it's, like, when it's played, because it is also played, you know, actually, you know, during the, like, when the Eclipse is happening, and, you know, when Griffith is doing, you know, his absolute worst atrocities on Guts and Casca, it does play during those moments, and I feel like I've seen that part of the anime, and I just, because of that, I personally associate the most with that moment. And but yeah, in general, with Griffith as a character and just like who he is as a person and just how, like, you know, he is this, you know, on the surface, this, like, you know, like physically, you know, this physically good looking, sort of like, you know, like elegant person, you know, on the surface, but like he is just, you know, this truly dark soul that will ultimately stop at nothing to, you know, to get what he wants out of the world and out of people. But yeah. And
the weirdest thing about what you tell me when you say that this plays during the actual Eclipse itself, and all of these people are being butchered by apostles and even worse stuff is happening, is like, it's repetitive. It doesn't build up. It doesn't progress towards any major kind of climax in the music or in the pitch or in the volume or anything like that. It just keeps going. It, I don't know, I don't want to read too much into this, and this probably is reading too much into it, but I almost feel like saying, it's almost like, you know, this is just Guts or Griffith accepting that this is just something that he needs to do in order to get to his goal. Like, it is just another thing. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Also, have you seen Berserk Volume 41? It came out in Japan and it looks great.
Yeah, I've seen the cover, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't look exceptional by any means. Like, not like Volume 27 or anything like that where you have the Berserker armor. But it certainly is a Berserk cover. That's no doubt there. I wonder who drew it, actually. I'm pretty sure it was probably Nero, but yeah, who knows?
Yeah. All right. So yeah, so getting right back into it, number four on my list is also Berserk. So yeah, back to back Berserk.
Nice.
But, yeah, I won't spend too much time talking about the Berserk soundtrack as a whole, because I think Quentin, like, encapsulated it pretty well, but
yeah, we both talked about it. I think, like,
we both talked about
but
it.
How about you play the track that you had lined up? I don't know if you had a different one lined up or if it was the exact
one. My sample track is, you know, of course, the cliche Guts theme, although I was heavily considering doing forces, but alas, I've chosen Guts's theme.
Also, Ghost is also amazing. Ghost is also like, my God, that weird synth bass. Ugh, it gives me a disgusting feeling.
Yeah, it sort of takes a bit to build up on you. But yeah, once the soundtrack is, oh, what a striking video. Pretty much like this slow sort of like build up and guts. It's really contemplating, which you wouldn't immediately get from a character like Guts, who is, you know, associated with being this big badass who will, you know, stop at nothing to, you know, to reach his goals. But yeah, I mean, it does reflect Guts's character in history very well. So just, yeah, like when it hits that like sort of like peak of the song where like, you know, you do have the it's just like, oh man, it's just beautiful. It's just so reflective of the masterpiece that is Berserk, and this, you know, this story that is, you know, that is tragic and, you know, dark and horrible, but at the same time beautiful and, you know, captivating.
Well, okay, yeah. Like, I don't want to read too much into the images that immediately come into my mind, but when I hear this track, I actually think of more of, like, a sunset, almost, or a sunrise, sorry, whereas the Baylet track, like I mentioned, is more like a sunset. It's like, I don't know, and again, this is my personal opinion, but those are just, like, the encapsulations of what these two different tracks make me feel. Like, Guts theme, it's like, you know, you've just completed, like, a whole night of slaughtering people, then you're half dead looking at the sunrise. Like, you know, it's just, and another image that comes to mind is when Guts is just laying on the ground looking at the stars in the Golden Age arc, or at least at the beginning of the Golden Age arc, after he's fought those wolves, basically. It is both lonely, and it also is so surprisingly gentle, as you said, for a character like Guts. I think that contrast is amazing, but it really comes into its own, ironically, after the portions that the anime covers. I think this goes perfectly with like Fantasia Guts, or even late Millennium Falcon Guts, like his gentleness and his increased willingness to kind of open up a bit more, you know. I think that's really where we see that Guts, you know, is actually a very gentle person, or at least a very vulnerable person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think it goes, and in general, I think it goes very well for like the more, you know, philosophical moments that Guts has, like, which are actually present in the Golden Age arc, which is what the anime, the 97 anime covers.
Yeah, yeah.
But mm-hmm. Yeah, where Guts is just sort of like, you know, thinking and like, just like, you know, like having this, like these deeply existential moments where he's just like questioning, you know, like who he is as a person really. And like why he does, and what he wants to get out of life, really. But yeah, mm-hmm. It just goes amazingly with those moments, no doubt. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I mean, I hate to move on from this because it is really a magical soundtrack, but I will say that the kind of limited tracks do sort of detract a bit from the major experience, because it isn't adaptable to every single moment, although to very many, because these tracks are very. They encapsulate a lot of what Berserk feels like, regardless of what scene it's in, because it really is always a bit tragic and not completely happy. But my number five spot is Gundam 00's soundtrack. So I love this composer so much. I have not watched Ghost in the Shell, but I have heard a few tracks from it, and they absolutely blow me away every single time. Kawai Kenji is a master of eeriness, this kind of eerie feeling. And he even is able to implement that into some of the kind of like the tracks that he writes for action sequences, which aren't like in any way kind of built up. They're just continuous kind of like, you know, epic events. Like, you know, it's not like we're waiting for some kind of big reveal or big scare or something like that. As you would expect from eerie scenes in like Ghost in the Shell, for example, this is more just like, you know, it is a very good battle sequence, which I think is something, you know, obviously I don't really have time to show you any kind or to listen to any kind of the eerier tracks that he made for the Gundam 00 anime, but this is just to show that he's capable of very kind of like action-packed kind of, I guess, proud and like really bold compositions, just like someone like Sagisu is. And yeah, let's just get into it straight away because my gosh, is he amazing. All right, 1 second. But yeah, so I had a Gundam phase, if any of you are wondering, when I still kind of watch anime a lot. And this was definitely the highlight, I would say. Yeah, I am pretty confident in saying that. Gundam 00 is an amazing series. Like, really. All right, hopefully everyone can sort of hear what it is here. There we go. Yeah, so I don't know if you heard it there, but for example, that violin that came in near to the end of the portion that I kind of recorded, that isn't a representation of that kind of weird kind of eeriness that sort of like, you know you're going towards something more than you are at the destination. Like, you know it's building up to something. But you also know that what is going on is serious, that there's a threat, and it really does encapsulate that threat. I think that's what Kawai Kenji really does well in this track and a lot of the other ones on the 00 kind of soundtrack is that kind of like, you know that, you know, things are progressing, the plot is going forward, but you know there's always going to be something else that you're going to have to brace yourself for when someone dies or, you know, some cataclysmic event erases all the progress that all the cast has made. And, you know, it's just like, I think it's like, you know, it's almost like doom within a battle. Like, you're fighting, you're succeeding, but you know something's at the end that will kind of take away your progress. I don't know, that's sort of my impression of it. And it probably does sound a bit like I'm, you know, making these things up and kind of BSing it as I go. But I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, but this soundtrack is very, very well-rounded, I will say, with a lot of incredible soundtracks of different paces and styles and tones that really complement all of the scenes that I think make 00 probably the best Gundam anime I've watched. I've watched a decent number. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my number.
Yeah, man. I mean, Gundam is just like this, like, this, just like this huge world that just like, I mean.
Okay, but it's not, that's the thing. It's even huger than you think because it's not one world. Every series is independent of the other. Like, Gundam 00 does not take place in the same timeline as the original Gundam, nor does Gundam IBO Iron-Blooded Orphans, nor does Gundam X. Like, they all are in different universes. And they're each very well developed, especially with like some kind of supplemental material like Ellen's light novels and some additional manga as well, which is really nice. Yeah, but the original, I will say, I've heard some incredible things about Gundam the Origin soundtrack. Gundam the Origin being the soundtrack that I don't know who composed it, but there were a few soundtracks I think created for the Gundam the Origin, which basically recaps the original anime in like a very well done, as of what I've heard, very well done CG adaptation of the original 1970s anime. And I think whatever came after running into the 80s. But this is what I've experienced with, and I have to say, I could not be happier with what Kawai Kenji did with the soundtrack.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so number three on my list is Hunter x Hunter. All right, so yeah, so Hunter x Hunter is, I feel like the Hunter x Hunter soundtrack very much captures like the multifaceted nature of the series, you know, that which starts out as very, you know, cheerful and exciting, sort of like how you would expect, you know, your typical shonen to be. But, you know, of course, as we all know, as for those of us who have read slash watched Hunter x Hunter, it does get, you know, darker as the series progresses, which, you know, hits its climax in the, I think in that Chimera Ant arc. But I'm actually focusing on the sample track I'm choosing is Legend of the Martial Artist, which is actually a very uplifting soundtrack from the Chimera Ant arc, which is later in the series. So yeah, all right.
Yeah, so just to mention, Hunter x Hunter will show up on my list as well, but there's so much to unpack, so I'm sure it won't be too repetitive.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean,
sorry, I think I lost the screen sharing for some reason.
Okay, here, let me try to see if I can give
you Slate works, or why you see the ads you do. Or want to know how we protect against spam, or how real people make search better. Visit YouTube to learn more about how search works.
This advertisement on YouTube.
All right, yeah, so that is Legend of the Martial Artist, which is a very epic soundtrack that I think encapsulates, you know, Netero, as well as the rest of, like, the sort of human attack team, which consists of Gon, the protagonist, and Killua, his friend, and their friends, as they sort of, like, invade the palace of the Chimera Antarchs, the Chimera Ants, who are the villains of the
gosh, I love this manga so much. I just remember, like, before this, you know, excluding a few moments from Berserk, there had not been a moment where I was this emotional experiencing any kind of fictional story. Like, there was none. It was just, I mean, you know, and this is a manga about climbing. And I mean, yes, it's a sports manga in certain senses, but it doesn't feel like that. It's no sort of like, it's not about the sport. It's not about the technicalities and the passion. Not really. It's about the role that this practice of climbing, this almost like, you know, this meditative practice of climbing has on this person. And how his personality, his insecurities, you know, shape his relationship with climbing and vice versa. That's what the whole series has been about so far. And, you know, we get to learn about this man's kind of relationship to others and how climbing, and there's like this triangle of his insecurities, climbing, and his relationships to others, and how those push and pull on each other constantly, and how climbing is this escape for him. But now that he has, after so much, and what was not even imaginable at the beginning of the story, an actual family, I guess, spoilers, he has a wife and kids and a kid that he obviously adores because he's a new father, and he's had this amazing life-changing experience of opening up to someone the way that he has, you know, and whereas before he was this emotionally scarred, just hermit, right? Like, now he has this amazing thing. And once again, he is thrown into the mix, this tear apart, which is, I mean, I'm saying that, but it's literally, you know, one of the things that is depicted by Sakamoto in this arc. And what's one of the things that makes Sakamoto's work in general amazing, but also, you know, this arc is a peak of that, in my opinion, is the way that he uses visuals, very detailed visuals. Mind you, Sakamoto is probably the best artist I've ever seen, maybe at the exception of Inoue, but even then you could argue, like, right, you know, the way that Sakamoto is able to make you feel things by literally just, you know, he's not saying, I'm not going to beat around the bush. He literally takes a double page to show you a building crashing down. This is the most commonly brought up example, but there's a reason for that. It's just genius. He literally takes a double page to depict a building crashing down on itself to make you understand the sound that the character is hearing when there's an avalanche. And it's just, it's perfect. Not to mention the art in here, even for Sakamoto standards, is peak. Like, you get all of these crazy winterscapes, you know, and this Aurorian kind of like landscape. And
Aurorian. That's like an immediate, like, just like,
yeah. Is that face? Nice. No, I was thinking the same thing when I used the word. But I mean, wow, New Jabez would be a good fit for this arc, nonetheless.
Really?
Yeah, it would. I mean, just because it's that's what climbing is. Basically, if you're not going in a team, and this is what, you know, he is a solo climber, at least for the second part of the arc, he is completely isolated and he is left there to whittle down his sanity to the bare bones. And like, he's just reflecting, going through this pain of the oxygen level diminishing. And it's almost like he's pushing himself to literally the hair's breadth away from death and experiencing all of these things. And I mean, the climax of this arc is probably the best climax I've ever experienced in any story. It's just, it's amazing. It's not the climax of this arc. It's the climax of the entire story, because this arc is the climax of the story to a certain extent, right? Because you basically, I can't even describe it. It's just, it's magical. For some reason, the author decided to, and I read this partially in Japanese, so decided to list the lyrics of, or not the lyrics, but the hymns that compose the song Saving Grace into this whole final chapter that he was writing. And for some reason it works. Like, on first glance, it's a little cheesy, but just seeing the way that, like, it's almost like he's just belittled by the world, even though he's accomplished his goal of climbing this impossible face that no one has ever like stepped on. This is virgin land, as he describes it, right? Like, it's just like, it's like he has been belittled by the universe. He has been crushed by it, his ego just destroyed. And he's just decided, you know, for this moment, I am going to basically sacrifice my ability to climb, which is something that is elaborated on in the epilogue. But it's just so crazy. And it's one of the things that makes the protagonist, Mori Buntaro, he's called something different then because he's married, but it's just so amazing. I can't get enough of just remembering this moment. Yeah, which says something.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, wow, that's sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. Yeah, I mean, that does sound I definitely get where you're coming from there. And I was and yeah, I know you mentioned like how Yas is all these sort of reflectful moments and reflective moments, and that is always nice to watch, where a character sort of like reflects and like, you know,
yeah.
And I guess, yeah.
But yeah,
I
imagine, like, Sakamoto is like a very visual storyteller, and these reflections that would, you know, in a lot of other manga's cases, be kind of mostly carried out through dialogue and maybe a few flashbacks. Here, it's not, there's not really a lot of flashback. It's literally, he manipulates what you're seeing in order to emphasize how these reflections are happening in his mind. Like, at one point, he literally reverts back to being a toddler, even though, you know, that's obviously not true. And, like, it somehow makes sense because he's starting to hallucinate because of the lack of oxygen, and it just all, like, you can believe it almost because, you know, you can't trust your eyes in this situation. Yeah, it's just really perfect. I mean, it's weird. It sounds to say that, but yeah.
Yeah. All right, so number three on my list is, I think I'm actually going to do a tie here. So for me, it's a tie between the Shogun assassination and the farewell Shinsengumi arcs from Gintama. So I feel like this is a very appropriate one to have as a tie, because these arcs are actually like right after like each other. Like the Shogun assassination like perfectly leads into, well, it leads right into the Feral Shinsengumi arc. And I feel like just these two arcs like are just really the high of, like, really the peak of Gintama in terms of its storytelling. And I feel like the following arcs, the battle over Akuyo and the final arc, Silver Soul, are both amazing as well. But I feel like these are just like the peaks. And yeah, and so like, with the Shogun Assassination, it just feels like it's just really this like high stakes like journey like the that the characters take. Like Gintoki and sort of his like comrades are sort of like tasked with the protecting the shogun after like assassins try to take his life. And yeah, it's just and it's also like, and there's also a very good fight within there as well. Where Gintoki fights Takatsuki, who for a lot of the series is like sort of like the main villain before the final villain Utsuro comes in. And that fight is really nice. And like, you know, it's what's interesting about it is that it's constantly like intermixed with like flashbacks from the two's childhood together. And it's like and I feel that it's a very nice way of showing like why Takatsuki like harbors all of this, you know, all of this like resentment and animosity towards Gintoki. And it is for a very good reason. You know, it's not like super justified. But you see why it is, and it's a very well written reason, I will say. So Takatsuki is you know, he hates Gintoki because Gintoki like ultimately carried out was forced to carry out, but nonetheless went through with it, the execution of their mentor, Shoyo Yoshida, who of course actually isn't dead because he's revealed to be Utsuro, the final antagonist, who is sort of like this like immortal, like undying dude. But nonetheless, it's just I feel like it's just like so well written, and of course like yeah, so and that like directly leads into you know with the shogun. Shiga actually losing his life ultimately. So like they aren't successful, but I feel like nonetheless it's just so well done, and because it perfectly leads into the next arc, the farewell Shinsengumi arc, where Shiga, the shogun's usurper, Nobunobu, sort of uses this opportunity to like turn the country against the Shinsengumi, who are sort of the main police force, and yeah, so like Utsuro, I mean, no, sorry, Kondo Isogo, the leader of the Shinsengumi, is sort of like is arrested, and the arc pretty much revolves around like the Yorozuya, Gintoki's comrades, and the rest of the Shinsengumi, sort of like joining forces to like get Kondo back. And I feel like it's just like it's very well done, because you get sort of like this further insight into the characters, and like and I guess what I'm trying to say is with these two arcs, like you see how Gintama is a very character like driven series, like you know it has a plot, it has a very good story in my opinion, but like the main like thing that propels it upward is like is the characters and like the interactions between them. And I feel like these two arcs just like really exemplify that, and these are just like the peaks of the story, I will say. So but yeah,
I mean I those are big names, like those two arcs names, I've heard them despite not even having like dipped my foot into Gintama as a series. I mean I've heard of them because they're that infamous, and I mean for good reason, it seems. Alrighty, so my number two spot is the appropriately second Yoshioka arc of Vagabond. I've talked about this arc before. Not going to talk too much about it because it is a bit of a spoiler-heavy thing, like even for the standards that we've set throughout this video. But that's mostly because it doesn't tie together. I'm not going to say it like plot-wise it ties together, but it really represents a point where even this stubborn character, protagonist Musashi, must face the kind of implications of his actions. And I think the way that is done with the Musashi versus 70 men battle, which I mentioned in our top 10 fights video, absolutely like amazing. Like one of the, it is, I think I have never experienced like that much of a like weird kind of like just haze, just like the protagonist has. The way that the fight just draws everything out is just, I'm not going to go into it again because we did talk about this recently, but it is amazing, especially considering the kind of little kind of drip drops of regret that Musashi has been experiencing, remorse that he's been experiencing throughout the arc, the way that, you know, basically he comes to Kyoto and one by one, you know, one step by another, his tension with the Yoshioka is just rocketing upwards. And the way that you realize it's not necessarily his fault that this is happening, but at the same time, you know, it is. It's just like you realize that this is the world of the warrior that Musashi chose. And you realize, you know, especially at the end of this arc, that Musashi is not ready to embrace that because he isn't completely mindless. He isn't a complete killer. And I mean, some people may include the post Yoshioka arc into the second, you know, second Yoshioka arc as well. I personally don't, but if you will, I mean, if you do, I think it's also like one of the best arcs in all of manga, because you get a direct contrast to the person that you that Musashi could have been in the form of Ittō Itōsai, this basically monster that has completely embraced the lifestyle of undefeated under the heavens. And, you know, it really forces all of this seed of doubt that has been planted into Musashi into fruition and basically sets his trajectory for the farming arc, which is where the manga has ended, or, you know, at least stopped serialization. Yeah, pretty amazing arc.
Yeah. Yeah, and definitely, and yeah, I think you've talked about it before, and yeah, I guess I do sort of like anticipate it to be, you know, the best arc of Vagabond, and I haven't gotten like super far in the series, but I've definitely, you know, I guess like the first Yoshioka arc has sort of like, I guess I mean I want to say prepared me. I don't know if it has really prepared me for the for that arc, the second arc. The second Yoshioka arc.
No, I'm sorry, I can't say yes.
It's, all right, okay. No, okay, it has right.
Not. But like, take that as a good sign. Take that as a good sign.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So, all right. So, fine. For my number two, I have the Thousand Year Blood War from Bleach. Yeah. So this is the final arc of the series, and it just, I feel it is really done well. I mean, even with what Kubo had to work with, and like ultimately being rushed to at least to a certain degree, but nonetheless it's just like so amazing, because I feel like this is really an arc, kind of like going back to like, you know, what I talked about with the Sasuke rescue arc, where like the side characters are just like, I mean, not that they weren't before, but like here they're just like given like, I feel like a bunch of them are just really given like these awesome moments to just like shine and just like be awesome. I feel like,
yeah,
to be honest and speaking, you know, Ichigo, you know, he is still, you know, obviously the protagonist, and he does like, you know, like the a lot of the heavy lifting in the arc, but in all honesty, I feel like the MVP of this arc,
yeah, like, what's his name
Kenpachi.
Yeah.
yeah Zoraki Kenpachi. He's just like the, you know, the captain of the 10th division of the Shinigami. And like, oh man, you just like, I mean, but really though, you get like all these, like you get these sort of like insights into his past and his like this sort of like shared history with the captains, Unohana of the 4th division.
And you see an incredible way of developing her character too, honestly.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And you get like her history, how she was like apparently the first Kenpachi, but then I mean the Kenpachi met her when he was younger. It's just like, it's so, yeah, I mean, seeing like that shared history, and of course their fight as well, is very rewarding. And and then you get like, of course, Kenpachi, you know, unlocking his Shikai. Yes, like I guess, you know, to give some more context, so Shikai and Bankai are the first the two releases of a Shinigami's Zanbakuto or sword that gives him like all these like, you know, separate like abilities or like power-ups. And and Kenpachi is just like this really crazy case, because Kenpachi has been able to become a captain and become like extremely powerful without even unlocking his Shikai. So when you finally see that, when his Shikai is just unlocked, it's just like, it's like insanely epic. And he just uses it in this like awesome way to like like stop a freaking to stop a meteor. It's just like,
yeah, against like this so character insane. Like I have to say Gremi versus Kenpachi is one of the best fights in Blood War, even considering how many good fights there are in Blood War. Oh my god.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then of course later on you get how I mean, and then later on you know it doesn't stop there.
It doesn't stop there.
Bunkai too.
That's like the vibe.
It's just insane, man. Like,
yeah.
I swear, when the anime, you know, finally gets released and we get these moments,
Kenpachi,
I swear, man, these are just gonna like break the internet. Yeah. At least like the anime internet, you know.
Well, I think
it's like, oh man, these insanely like hype moments, just like, but they're so well done.
I just really hope that, you know, they're able to do the art in this arc in the manga justice in the anime, because the art, like, I mean, I don't think many people would argue, reaches its peak in the Blood War. Oh my god, it's crazy. Yeah.
But yeah, nonetheless, I mean, and of course with Ichigo himself like getting his like his history of like how his parents sort of met, and like, and the reasoning for why he has the powers that he does is also really well done. And you also, like, you know, you kind of see how, you know, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, Ichigo is like this you know, anomaly. He is like this sort of like combination of all these different like factors within Bleach, but it just this arc really shows you just like how well executed it really is. And it's just like it's so rewarding. For a final arc, it is very satisfying.
Even for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I could go on all day about that arc. And I mean, the reason it's not on this list is just because I did try to include like a bit of like that narrative quality in terms of preference. I think it would definitely be in my top 10. But just if I'm trying to balance those two out, I think it would be just outside. So just outside of me having been able to mention it. But I love that arc and I'm so excited for the animated adaptation for sure. In any case, my first arc, my number one arc is, I mean, I guess it's not really any surprise that it's from Berserk, but I think it might actually surprise some people as to which one it is, but it's the Falcon of the Millennium arc. I think, you know, a lot of people...
That's how I, dude, that's, I'm sorry, but yeah, that's my actually my number one as well.
Oh, I was kind of scared there for a minute. I mean, so Conviction is obviously a beast unto itself, right? Conviction is great. The incarnation ceremony, everything. But that just, you know, talking about that kind of melancholy tinge that I mentioned earlier, right? Like, what makes Berserk Berserk, the Guts theme vibe, you know, that is this arc. Because it's not just sadness, anger, which, I mean, not to say that it's bad. You know, previous parts of the Conviction arc and even the Golden Age arc have done that kind of idea justice. But in this arc, just seeing Guts actually be happy, even if it's for a few fleeting moments, it just contrasts that dark, just hopeless world of Berserk so well. And also just the way that everything is just executed on, oh my god, like, we may as well talk about this together, but like,
oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I mean, seeing like Guts, you know, happy is just like, is great in and of itself. But I mean, I feel like also seeing like his, you know, like seeing his party, like, you know, finally get like fully assembled, it's just like really rewarding as well. Like, getting to like meet Shirke, and like seeing like, you know, like,
and the Berserker like, armor,
the Berserker armor, yes, and like, oh man, and the fights in these are like yes. Right off the bat, we get like probably, I mean, I think we both agree, like the best fight in the series with like, you know, Guts versus Zod, their second fight. You know, at
that, like, that's sword. Opening the freaking arc. That is opening
exactly. Arc. Yeah, it's like, oh my god, like, wow, like, what a way to open our arc, you know. But then, and of course, later on, we get, you know, Guts versus Ensign versus Ganishka, which is just, oh my god,
it's one of like, the, if not the best panel in all of manga, honestly, oh my god, that was epic. But, I think Ganishka, I don't think he's talked about enough, like. While I don't think he was necessarily a character to be marveled at in terms of how he's written, I don't think that was the point. I think the point was that he was a gimmick to a certain extent, but not in a bad way. He was a plot device, but in a way that was like sensical, because he wasn't even human. He was just singularly obsessed with power, and he was singularly inferior and insecure in his relationship to the God Hand. And just the way that, like, he just got screwed over, basically. That's, you know, there's no other way to say it. Like, it's just, oh my god. And then Skull Knight showing up at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my god. And that one panel, dude, like with like
Femme, that is another contender for one of the best panels in all of manga, no doubt.
Seriously though, yeah.
Yeah,
it's like, man, like you know, it's like, and you have to think, like, I think you've mentioned this as well, but you have to think, like, somebody thought of all this, and somebody had the vision to like put all of this together. It's just like,
yeah,
Miura, wow, it's just like this,
yeah,
insane. This honestly, this mad scientist, if you think about it, he's like, wow, you know.
Yeah, because it seems visionary. Impossible. It's just like, I remember when I mentioned that as well. Like, I didn't mention it exactly like you did, because you put it in a very good way. But my point when I mentioned it in the previous episode was more like, it's almost like this work transcends reality, like, or the reality that this is a story, right? And it becomes reality to a certain extent. It's just that real feeling because of how complicated everything is. But it's still a story, because it gives you the perspective that you need to make it enjoyable, but also just like captivating. You cannot look away. And this arc is obviously, I think, an embodiment of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. And then also, like, you know, and there's also the added bonus that, like, the whole arc in and of itself is just, like, it's just like this huge Star Wars reference. Like, you know, it's the Millennium Falcon is just like, you know, it's just fun, because, you know,
yeah.
I guess, I mean, I you know, we're both fans of Star Wars, and of course,
yeah,
Miura is as well. It's just, it's fun to see his little references.
Wait, like, why the Millennium again? Just because of the cyclical god hand, like the cycle of the spiral of fate or something like that? Because I get the Falcon part, obviously, but why the Millennium? The Falcon of the Millennium.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I feel like it could be like how, like, you know, it could be, maybe like, maybe this, like, sort of like,
it's the kingdom of the Millennium, like, I don't know. So yeah, I guess, like, yeah, I get what it, I don't think there's like an explicit reason that's stated or hinted at either, but I guess you could extrapolate for sure. Yeah,
yeah, like, I maybe how, like, Griffith is like this sort of like this ruler of the Millennium, basically. This, yeah, like, kind of like how you would say, oh, like, this is the fight of the century.
Yeah, yeah,
like, I guess same sort of thing, like. Like, Griffith is the Falcon of the Millennium. The
how many years are there between each eclipse? Again, 500, right? Like, that's the kind of thing.
I think it's actually less. I think it's
300?
200 something, actually.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Because, like, so basically, well, wait. That makes sense. Because I don't know why we're going into theory territory right now, but there are 5 Godhead members. So it's like he's the 5th one. Right, so 5 times 200.
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
Wow, yeah. I never thought about that. I mean, yeah, wow.
Well, because basically, like, I think that kind of signals, like, he is the final Godhead member, because there are 5 fingers on a hand, right? So there are 5, and it's like, this is the Millennium. Like, he is the one. You know what I'm saying? I have to stop myself with this arc. It's so good, so good.
Yeah.
In any case, this has probably been a pretty long episode. Hopefully you've enjoyed at least some portions of it. I've had a blast. And I mean, we'll see you guys next time we record, you know, and hopefully we'll be kind of bringing in an interesting discussion topic to the table next time. Alrighty.
Yeah. All right. Keep struggling. On the
Berserker note, strugglers.
Yes.
Ciao. また夜が明ければお別れ、夢は時幻に